Welcome to Extreme Genes, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And welcome to America's Family History Show, Extreme Genes and ExtremeGenes.com. It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth, on the program where we shake your family tree and watch the nuts fall out. And this episode is brought to you by BYU TV's Relative Race. And we got some great guests for you today. The first coming up in about 10 minutes is Colin Colborne. He's with a project called the Bent Prop Project. And they're out often using their own money and certainly contributions, finding the remains of mostly World War II-era flyboys and bringing the remains home. And you're going to hear some amazing stories coming up about that a little bit later on. And then later in the show, we're going to talk to Allison Gunner Johnson. She has found her birth mother through the DNA process, and then she's become what they call a search angel. And she'll tell you a little bit about that and the benefits, of course, in helping others to do pretty much what she has done. Then we talk to Team Green today from Relative Race, talking about the first two episodes and their experience in that as we make our way through season four on BYU TV. And then Tom Perry will be back, our preservation authority, talking about what to do if your stuff gets wet. You know, we have a lot of people on the East Coast now dealing with the effects of Hurricane Florence, and it's been a while since we touched on that, so we'll be talking about that a little bit later on. But right now, it's time to head out to Boston, Massachusetts, where my good friend David Allen Lambert is standing by. He is the chief genealogist of the New England Historic Genealogical Society and AmericanAncestors.org. You've been a busy man lately, David.
Yeah, if I'm not in Beantown, I'm in somebody else's town. And tomorrow I leave for Louisville, Kentucky to be at the Sons of the American Revolution leadership out there in Louisville for a few days. So off there, and a couple of weeks after that at the British Institute in Salt Lake City, where I'm actually learning instead of teaching for a change.
Very nice.
Great.
And you were on the Constitution here recently, the USS Constitution. Tell us about that.
Well, the oldest commissioned Navy ship, commissioned back in October 1797 and still afloat, she had the opportunity for educators to go out on a turnaround cruise, which only happens a few times a year, and usually the wait list is long. I lucked out, got on it, and got to be on the deck when she fired a 21-gun salute out in the middle of the harbor at Castle Island. So it was great, so much history, chance to meet the Navy sailors that are actually on board, because she is still an active Navy ship. And it was a lot of fun, something I'll remember for the rest of my life.
Unbelievable. Well, let's get to our family histoire news today. And where do you want to start?
Well, I think appropriately for the family history news, we should start with what happened 100 years ago this week. The anniversary of the Meuse-Argonne Offensive, which was one of the bloodiest parts of the Great War, World War I, but it actually helped bring an end to the war. And this was probably a battle that many of our listeners had family that were on. I mean, many people were gassed in the Argonne Forest during this time frame and suffered the effects living into their 90s.
That's right.
If not longer. It's been a number of years since Frank Buckles died, our last World War I veteran, but again, we are now at the century mark, and there were plenty of children of World War I veterans, and recently you had a World War I widow that you grew up nearby online,
yeah,
didn't you?
She was on the show. That's right. Mrs. Douglas Campbell, and she is the widow of America's first flying ace who lived in Connecticut near me.
That's amazing. Well, our next story goes about 60 years later. This is baby Lilac, who was an abandoned baby found by a lilac tree in 1978 in Rochester, New York. Well, now she wants to find out who her real birth mother is. Here's the clincher. You would think the quick answer would be use DNA. So far, she has found no relatives on Ancestry or 23andMe. I would say MyHeritage might be another option, and other DNA testing companies that are out there, and spread the autosomal around, as they say.
Well, I'm hoping that she'll get it over to GEDmatch as well, where a lot of people come to meet, right?
That really is true. GEDmatch and DNA Painter to even go further with analysis, which is a great thing to do. DNA has done it again. Now the remains of a World War II U.S. Marine who died during the Battle of Tarawa in November of 1943 and buried originally in Hawaii have been identified due to DNA results. And they have matched with a family. While Leonard Timon has now been identified and his remains have been brought back to the Chicago area where he now has been buried with military honors.
That is so awesome. You know, it's amazing the things that come out of DNA, and so many of the stories are somewhat similar as we talk about, but there's always a twist to every one of them. And here's a guy, they had the remains, they brought him back from an island, they buried him in Hawaii, and now here it is, three quarters of a century later, and he's been brought back with his family because of DNA. Incredible.
Mm-hmm. It really is. Well, this week, my blogger spotlight shines on Jen Rickards of Union, Missouri. She has a blog called Auntie Jen's Family, and the blog can be found at auntiejenstrees.blogspot.com. She brought up an interesting point, and I think that is something we all have to think about it from time to time, is where were we on September 11th? And she blogged, "Where were you when the world stopped turning?" She also blogs about epitaphs on gravestones and a variety of other interesting topics. She's a new blogger to the scene, so give her some blogger spotlight love and go and visit auntiejenstrees.blogspot.com.
And isn't that interesting? You think about that. Yeah, where were we on 9/11? Some of us remember when JFK was shot. Some of us remember when Pearl Harbor was attacked. I mean, those are the moments where you just capture that history and you have your own experience with it.
And it's something that if you don't keep a journal or if you want to do a journal about your life, that's one of those key dates that you can recollect where you were and write it down. I was here at NEHGS doing a consultation. And, yeah, that changed the entire world for us, didn't it?
It sure did.
Well, that's all I have from Beantown. Off to Louisville, Kentucky. Then I'll stop into the Louisville Slugger Museum, which is around the corner from where I'm meeting, and take a look at a little bit of baseball history, because I know I love that as much as genealogy, and I know you do, too.
I do. All right, David, thanks so much. Have a great trip, and we'll catch up with you again next week.
Sounds great.
And there's a remarkable project that's out there right now that's doing an amazing amount of good in finding the remains of missing in action service members from many wars, including back to World War II, maybe even sooner. It's called the Bent Prop Project. Easy for me to say. And one of the people who's involved in that is on the line with me right now from Leesburg, Virginia. He's Colin Colborne. And Colin, welcome to the show. It's great to have you. I'm just really excited to hear about the Bent Prop Project.
Thanks very much, Scott. I appreciate it. I'm very happy to be on as well.
So when did this thing start?
Well, so the Bent Prop Project is actually one partner of a larger partnership called Project Recover. And Project Recover was formalized in 2016, though it was originally founded in 2012. And it's actually a partnership between the Bent Prop Project, which is a nonprofit that's been searching for MIAs for about 25 years.
Okay.
And the University of California, San Diego's Scripps Institution of Oceanography, and the University of Delaware's College of Earth, Ocean, and Environment. And the three groups together form the partnership, which is called Project Recover.
Wow. And you guys go all over the world. You do this on your own time. You do this often with your own money, right?
We have charitable donations that help us operate around the world. And that has helped us go global. Bent Prop originally started with Dr. Pat Scannon searching for MIAs in Palau, and a group of volunteers often paid their way. And, you know, to be honest, the successes that they've had, especially now with the other two partners, has allowed us to go global.
Wow.
And so where we started in Palau, you know, we've got active operations all over the world, Europe. You can find us on our website. We've just got back from Kiska and the Aleutian Islands. And we have been, of course, all over the Pacific trying to find aircraft as well.
Now, Palau, for people who aren't familiar with it, was a Japanese-held series of islands, and a lot of our guys were shot down there. And I know you made the recovery from one wreck site of like 8 sets of remains that were brought back to Arlington, which is just incredible to me.
Yeah. B-24 crew that was discovered, and that was just the beginning. Just this year, in fact, we've had 3 funerals, I believe, in 2018, of other aircraft that were discovered off Palau as well.
Wow, from World War II.
Yes, sir, all World War II.
And does most of your work involve World War II, or do you do some as well with Korea and Vietnam?
We do focus mostly on World War II, and of course, that's part and parcel of the fact that the numbers of the missing. I like to tell people, you know, there are roughly 2,000 to 3,000 still missing from Vietnam. There are roughly 8,000 still missing from Korea. And the number we still use today is there are still 72,000 missing from World War II.
Oh, my gosh.
So just by way of pure numbers, and especially because most of the Pacific is still relatively undisturbed, especially underwater sites, that really leads us toward cases in World War II. But we do not exclusively just work on World War II cases.
Sure. So do governments cooperate with you in this? I mean, you mentioned that you're working over in Europe as well as in the Pacific. Are the governments of those countries that are involved, are they cooperative?
Absolutely. We make sure when we go to any country that we work with, the governments and the local institutions that govern those, the areas that we're searching, whether it's, you know, in Papua New Guinea, we worked with the National Museum. That was very important. We work with universities in Europe and third-party groups in Europe that also work with the government. And we, of course, work with the U.S.'s Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency, the DPAA, who also, through our partnership, helps us work around the world.
So over all these years, you mentioned that Bent Prop actually goes back like 25 years. How many sets of remains have you recovered?
I would say it's probably been almost 20 sets of remains that have come home to their family.
20 sets. Wow. Tell us some of the stories of some of these people.
Well, I joined in 2016, and so I'm a lot more familiar with some of the more recent groups and funerals and discoveries. The biggest one recently was the Heaven Can Wait B-24, which was a B-24 that went down off of Papua New Guinea, off of Hansa Bay. That B-24 went down in relatively deep water, roughly 213, 215 feet of water.
Wow.
We were able to find it, and that's at the top range of what we look for, because with Project Recover, our job is to find the airplanes. We use 21st century technology, side scan sonar, ROVs, AUVs, to find airplanes in relatively shallow water that have never been discovered before. And the reason why we focus on that is because the Defense Department, they're generally limited by the depth that divers can go in order to retrieve the remains. So
sure.
Our focus is just to find the aircraft, and then we relay all our information to the U.S. government to retrieve the remains at their discretion, because, of course, each case is different.
Right.
So we searched generally in shallower waters, and we found late last year in 2017, we found a B-24 off Hansa Bay that was in 213 feet of water. And the reason why I think this is an especially special case, perhaps to your listeners, is that the reason we were able to get as far as we have with that was because the family actually contacted us. We got an email early on from a family member that had been researching their family member who had gone down with the aircraft. And once we had decided to go to that area, because we knew there were several aircraft that had crashed there, and one of the ways that we prioritize where we look is if there are multiple aircraft,
sure,
so that we have a much higher chance of finding aircraft. So this often happens around large targets, especially in the Pacific, Japanese targets, or runways, places where a lot of airplanes would have crashed. And this plane, while it was on our list, we didn't have a whole lot of information. And it turned out that when the family contacted us, that they had already been doing 5 years of research on their family members' aircraft.
Wow. Was their research pretty accurate when it came to where the plane was found?
It was very accurate. I mean, to be quite honest, it was very accurate. They had done a very good job. And I credit the family. Professor of political science at the University of Illinois, Scott Althaus, was the family member that was working with us specifically. But his entire family, they had gone to universities and other archives in order to find information on this stuff.
Wow.
And I'm the lead historian with Project Recover, and so it's my job to gather intel on all the aircraft and help put us on the right place. But because we have so many cases all over the world, it is a huge help to have an independent family do all of the research ahead of time and basically just deliver it to us and say, hey, we've done all this research. We believe the airplane is here based on these factors. And it was a really high quality research.
And how many remains did you find there?
Well, there were 10 crew missing from that aircraft.
Okay. And were you able to recover
some of
them?
Although we believe... Well, that is up to the discretion of the Defense Department, and we are hoping that they are going to go and conduct a recovery at that site.
Okay. So that hasn't happened yet.
The full recovery has not happened yet, but I can tell you that from the family's perspective, just finding the site was such a huge relief for them.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
There's something that having a missing family member does to traumatize a family for many generations. It doesn't just stop with the people who directly knew the person. And I think even most families may not even realize that that trauma is there. And certainly with this particular case, it was a huge deal for them that we found this aircraft.
Sure.
And we were so, so happy to have helped.
Have they actually gone to the site now themselves?
No, they have not gone. It is in a very remote location in Papua New Guinea. Not that that would ever stop them. But what they are doing is they're working with DPAA to help prioritize their aircraft and get recovery efforts out there to bring those guys home.
Boy, what a great thing. It's the Bent Prop Project. Colin Colburn is part of this out of Leesburg, Virginia. Tell me about the story of one of the people whose remains you were able to recover that touched your heart.
Well, we have recently found an aircraft that was a Hellcat aircraft in Palau. And the pilot's name was First Lieutenant William Pinnell. He was a Navy Reserve Lieutenant. And I was in an F-6F-3 Hellcat, and they were on a strafing mission in Palau. And his aircraft took some pretty bad anti-aircraft fire and was seen to take a direct hit. He crashed roughly 300 feet from the seaplane base and sank there. For a long time, Bent Prop had been trying to locate that aircraft, and it was with the help of these advanced sonar AUVs that we were able to find the aircraft. And while we have had a number of funerals for other aircraft that we have located, this one was the first funeral I got to go to at Arlington Cemetery. Mm-hmm. And as I'm sure you know, when you go to Arlington Cemetery, it's a big deal.
Yes.
And to be able to speak with the family members there and to have been a very small part of their loved one coming home, it had a real impact on me.
I bet that's true. How often do you have these funerals at Arlington?
It depends. Families are allowed to choose whether they want their loved ones to come home to a local cemetery or to go to Arlington. And in the past few years, there have been, I believe, two Arlington funerals, and I think we may be having another one coming up soon. And there have been a number of local funerals as well. And, you know, each has their own wonderful feel to it. The Arlington funerals have this great military pomp and circumstance. And you're in where all the legends of the American military are, and you're there, and it has this great feeling. But local funerals have this wonderful feeling that the whole town comes out, and you have the police and sirens and fire trucks and parades, and both are so equally astonishing to experience. And we are just very happy to be a small part of that.
He's Colin Colburn from Leesburg, Virginia, part of the Bent Prop Project. Colin, where can they find out more about the project?
Yeah, absolutely. You can find more at projectrecover.org and thebentprop.org.
Colin, it's been a delight visiting with you. I wish we had more time, but you're doing great work and so grateful for people like yourself who are involved in bringing these boys home.
Thanks so much, Scott. I really appreciate you speaking with me today.
Hey, back at it on Extreme Jeans, America's Family History Show, and ExtremeJeans.com. It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth, and this segment is brought to you by FamilySearch.org. And you know, we have quite a community with Extreme Jeans. We're on Facebook, we're on Twitter. People follow us on our Extreme Jeans website. And one name that I've seen come up for some time now is Allison Gunner Johnson. I guess we actually met at Roots Tech a couple of years ago, right, Allison?
That's right, Roots Tech 2017, where this kind of started for me.
Yeah, and I've been seeing you everywhere. Your story has been incredible to me because here you were a longtime genie of, a couple of decades. And then about a year and a half ago, you decided to take the plunge into your biological family because you were adopted. Let's talk about all this stuff. Why did you avoid the bio family for so long?
You know, growing up, I grew up in a wonderful family, and I just never really even thought about looking for my biological family. You know, every once in a while, I think, I wouldn't mind seeing them in a grocery store to just maybe see what they look like, but not meet them. But that thought came and went rarely. So the reason I actually went to Roots Tech in 2017 was I had a good friend invite me. And so we went together, and she was very into the DNA testing. She had tested all her children and her husband, and now was testing the spouses of her children. And, and the whole Roots Tech, she was going to these DNA classes, and I really didn't know much about it. But Ancestry had these great sales on their DNA kits at Roots Tech. So I went ahead and bought three of them, one for me, one for my sister, who's also adopted, and one for my husband. And so that's kind of how it started.
And obviously you knew that the possibility was there that you were going to have that chance to run into your bio family and see what they looked like in the grocery store as a result of this.
Right.
Did that frighten you?
Well, truthfully, going into it, I thought, I'm just really doing this to find out about my ethnicity.
Yeah.
And then, you know, when those results come in and you're seeing, you know, the names of people who are related to you on your match list, it's kind of impelling. Now look at this. I'm so close. Now, granted, when I first got my results back, the closest I had was third cousins. And I just thought, oh, I don't want to do that much work.
Sure. Yeah, right.
To figure it out. So I just kind of waited. But in the meantime, I did do a couple things. I had joined a couple of Facebook groups, DNA Detectives by C.C. Moore,
yep,
and Genetic Genealogy Tips and Techniques by Blaine Bettinger. And I also got updated birth background information from the county I was born in. As a child, I had been given about a half a page of information. And so I wrote, and a couple months later, I got back 4 pages of birth background information. It was fantastic. So thank goodness I had, you know, kind of been on DNA Detectives and Genetic Genealogy Tips and Techniques, and I learned about uploading my raw data from Ancestry into FamilyTree DNA, MyHeritage, and GEDmatch.
Yes.
And so occasionally I would check each of those sites and see if I had anything closer. And a year ago, July, one morning, checked FamilyTree DNA, and lo and behold, on there I had a very close match that was either a half-sibling, uncle, nephew, or grandparent, grandchild.
Wow.
So I knew I was close, and that it wouldn't take much effort, you know, to
sure
figure this out.
Yeah.
You know, on NFT DNA, they have the email address of the person. I was a little confused because the test taker, it said the gender was male, but the name on the test was a female's name. So I shot off an email right away and said, hey, I'm so excited, you know, we're related and I'm adopted and I would love to find out more about you and how we're connected, but I'm a little confused because of this male-female thing. And, you know, looking back, I realized that that was not the way to do it. But, you know, what I did while I waited for an answer that never came was create a tree based on the female name
right
of that test. And so I, you know, built it back a couple generations and then came back forward looking for all the descendants. And as I did that, using my birth background information that told me my birth mother was a certain age and had an older sister this age and a younger brother this age.
Yep.
I came right back to that name that was on the test, and she was my birth mother.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
Yes, pretty amazing.
Now, why is it she came up then as not an immediate family member?
I found that later after I met her that the test was actually her brother's test. So
I
it was
see
my birth uncle. She had just was managing it and put her name on it.
Wow. How interesting is
that?
Well, the thing that I really appreciate about your story, Allison, because a lot of people are able to do some of the things you're doing, although I think you've really highly educated yourself in this area to make it work. You're using CC's techniques. You're using Blaine's charts. I mean, you're using all the tools that are out there. But then you went on to start helping others. You became one of those genealogical angels.
Right. You know, my youngest left for school last September, and this was right about that time that I had reached out to my birth family and was waiting to see if they were going to respond. And with him gone, I kind of thought, okay, now what's my purpose in life? What's my mission?
Yeah.
And I thought about it, and I thought, okay, what are you good at? You seem to be pretty good at this DNA stuff, because I also had figured out who my sister's birth parents were. And you really love genealogy and family history, I think I want to be a search angel. And fortunately, just a few weeks later, I met a gal at our local DNA special interest group who mentioned she was a search angel. And I asked her if she would be my mentor. And we met together and exchanged ideas and strategies. And it's just kind of gone from there.
Wow. Now, how many people have you helped? Give us some of the stories from those experiences.
So, as I mentioned, I did help my younger sister find her birth family.
Yep.
Through DNA testing on Ancestry, we found a first cousin of hers. Funny enough, that first cousin grew up across the street from the woman that my brother ended up marrying, the girl that lived across the street from this first cousin, and their families were friends. So it's amazing what a small world it is.
Yeah.
But through DNA testing, we also found my sister, a half-brother that she did not know about, and she has plans to meet him soon. So I have found so far about 12 birth mothers and 10 birth fathers, and in the 30s, siblings and half-siblings.
Sure. Right. And when you say you found them, they're not all living, I'm assuming. Many are not.
No, you're correct. I discovered who they were as far as the relationship to the person I was helping.
Yeah. It's a fascinating thing to do because some of these relationships don't come out the way you would hope. I think most of them do. I think most of them come out very positive.
The ones I've helped who have reached out so far have all been positive experiences.
Yeah.
And in my case, it turned out that my birth parents ended up marrying many years later.
Oh, wow.
They stayed together from my birth on, but they married many years later. And I actually have a full brother who is 13 years younger than me.
Huh.
So I got to meet my birth mother last October. And then this last August 5th, on my 53rd birthday, I got to meet my birth father and my brother.
Wow. What a great story, Allison.
Present.
If somebody wants to become a search angel, where should they go?
Oh, you know, it's a tricky thing because there's not, as far as I know, a course. For me, it was those two Facebook websites and learning all that I could. And then people have just come by referral. You know, I've been helping somebody solve a case, and then they recommend me to one of their friends, and then I start helping somebody else, or somebody has connected into the DNA matches and has said, hey, I'm adopted, you know, and can you help me?
Great stuff. She's Allison Gunner Johnson from Arizona. Allison, thanks so much for your time and for all the things you're doing. It sounds like you're doing great work.
Thank you. I love it.
You can sure tell. Hey, welcome back to Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show, and ExtremeGenes.com. And as you know by now, Relative Race is underway for another season, season 4, on BYU TV. And it's on every Sunday night at 9 o'clock Eastern and 6 o'clock Pacific time. And I'm excited. I got the members of Team Green on the line with me right now. It's Precious and Paris Anderson. They're from Ohio. How you guys doing?
We are good. Hi, everyone.
You sound good. What an experience for you. Have you ever done television before?
No, this was our very first time doing television.
All right. So, well, fill us in now. What made you think you wanted to be on this show?
I have been searching for a while for relatives of mine. So I came up on Dead End and Dead End, and when we heard about this from a friend and we watched some of the seasons, we were like, we definitely have to give this a try.
Oh, that's so fun. And I'm glad you did. Now, you were actually racing from where to begin with?
We started off in North Carolina.
That's
where. Wakefield, right?
Wake Forest.
Wake Forest,
okay.
Yeah.
And did you get to pick the color of your car, Paris?
I mean, it stood out, but no, we didn't pick it. You know, it was actually,
it was assigned.
Given to us.
Paris is the green guy.
I thought the green would have been darker. The car is kind of a lime green.
Lime green, yeah. Like that carpet back in the 70s. I get it. So what was the highlight for you? We've seen the first two episodes, and Precious, it seems to me that you had quite an experience there.
Oh, yes. From just day one of starting out with our challenges and the relative Paris met, and then for me, being able to meet an aunt for the first time was just amazing.
Wow.
Definitely a great experience.
Now, she's your aunt. Now, this was your mom's sister or your father's?
This is my mom's sister.
So you were an adoptee?
Yes. I was adopted around the age of 7. So from then, I just only really had names to really go off of, no other visits or no other family members that I really stayed in contact with.
So meeting this aunt had to be a particularly special moment for you. What did you feel when you opened that door and she told you what her role was in your life?
I was just really just blown away by actually being able to actually meet her and see someone that looked similar to me. And then just to hear that she was my aunt was just overwhelming. To finally have some type of connection right then and there. It was just a heartfelt moment. Emotional, a sigh of relief to finally have something.
Yes, for the first time. How long had you been looking?
It's been over 10 years once I actually got of age to really understand everything. I've been searching for quite some time, even in college before me and my husband got married. It's always just been questions, and I've been online and emailing and even calling. I would call to try to see if I could find something.
How did you feel about that moment for Precious, Paris?
No, it was definitely a highlight because, to be honest, me coming on the show, it was more so from a supportive standpoint. So me meeting who I met the first time, you know, it was fine. You know, we enjoyed it, but I just wanted to see what they had in store for Precious, you know, because at the end of the day, that was the biggest reason why we did it. So to finally get that first step, it was a highlight, man, and it was priceless. It was the first step towards the closure that we were looking for. So it was definitely, you know, a big moment for both of us.
Now, are you still in touch with her, Precious?
Yes, we still talk on a daily basis.
Wow.
So we definitely stay in contact.
Well, this is Team Green. It's Precious and Paris Anderson from Ohio. And, of course, you can watch Relative Race on BYU TV Sunday nights at 9 o'clock Eastern Time and 6 o'clock Pacific. Another episode coming right up this weekend. Thanks so much, you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And good luck, Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com. He is our preservation authority. And Tom, you know, it has been a while since we spoke about what you do with wet stuff. And with Hurricane Florence causing so much havoc on the East Coast right now, I think it might be a good time for a review on how you can restore some of these things, how you might be able to salvage some things that might otherwise be lost. But I mean, think about it. You got family Bibles, you got documents, you've got photographs, you've got slides, you've got negatives. All of these things, I would imagine, require a little different treatment when wet, yes?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, if you think, well, I don't live on the coast where they have hurricanes, I don't need to worry about it. Look what's going on out west with all the fires. And with fire, there's a lot of water, and you can have damage with your house. Maybe you got burned a little bit, but the water that came in through the attic, through your burnt roof, did more damage than the fire itself to your heirloom. So you need to really be careful with things like that, too, and preservation before the fact is important also.
Yeah, let's talk about preservation, though, after the fact, considering Hurricane Florence now. So let's start with paper documents. What would you suggest is the best way to salvage those when they get wet?
Okay, the first thing you want to do is get a hold of them as fast as you can. There's nothing more important than paper things that have gotten wet. A lot of other things can take less time to fix, like videotapes, but photos, paper documents, things like that, you need to get on immediately. And what I recommend is if it's not water-soluble type things like inkjet, you want to get distilled water so it has no chemicals or anything in it, and you want to bathe all your documents to get all the mud and different things like this off of them, and then hang them up to dry or lay them on a towel. And if you're going to do different layers, make sure you put wax sheets of paper between each one of them. It's so critical.
Yeah, because you don't want them to stick together, obviously. So really, documents, paper documents, are in the same category as photographs.
Oh, absolutely, completely. And the thing is, with photographs, you have the emulsion, which actually turns you into a glue when it's wet. So you need to act on these quick. And if you're in a situation you've got a lot of these that are water damaged and you don't have time to deal with them right now, what you need to do is put them in Ziploc bags. And I hate to do this, but this is about the only option you have if you can't get to them. Put them in the freezer or the refrigerator to stop the growth of mold. And then when you have the time, you can go and thaw them out. You can get them unstuck if they're stuck together. Because if you wait and let them dry together, the chances are really slim you're ever going to get them apart again.
Boy, you make such great points here, and there's so many aspects to this. What about negatives? Now, that they tend to curl when they get wet?
Yes, they will curl up, but the good thing about negatives is you can always get them wet again, and you can hang them with a clothesline with a weight on the bottom of them, and they'll stretch them out and they're dry again. But with those, you need to be really, really careful. I hate putting negatives in the freezer because the emulsion itself can crack and cause problems. So you probably want to stick with the refrigerator. You know, you really don't want to go in the freezer unless you have no other alternative because you can damage your emulsion.
And I should mention, too, when you have certain paper things that get just wrinkly, that they have waves in them, there's actually a process that you can go through at your local framers where they can cause the paper to relax again, and then they can mount it on foam core, and it's perfectly flat and perfect once again. And I've done it myself. I had some old historic news newspapers, and they were really pretty much destroyed in a flood we had, and they are perfect now. You'd have no idea. Tom, great stuff, and we've covered a lot of ground here. There's a lot more, I'm sure, but if you have a question for Tom Perry, you can send him an email at asktom@tmcplace.com, or you can drop him a note on Twitter at AskTomP. Thanks so much, Tom. We'll talk to you again next week.
My pleasure.
Hey, that is a wrap on this week's show. I am Fisher. Thanks so much for joining us. Next week, by the way, we're going to talk to Team Black from Relative Race and get their take on the first 3 weeks. Don't forget, Relative Race is on Sunday nights, 9 o'clock Eastern, 6 o'clock Pacific, and all the times in between on BYU TV. And it's weekend number 3 coming up right now. Hey, don't forget to sign up for our weekly Genie newsletter. That is absolutely free, and you can get it through our website, extremejeans.com, or on our Facebook page. Talk to you again next week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, as far as everyone knows, we're a nice, normal family.
This has been Extreme Genes. Share your family story by going to FamilySearch.org.